Hi, everyone. I've been asked to say happy St. Patrick's Day. I'm Antonia Maione, director of the McGill Institute for the Study of Canada. And I'd like to welcome you all to the third lecture in the McGill Institute for the Study of Canada's 2009-2010 Distinguished Lecture Series. And I'm very happy to say this is the fourth Deakin Lecture since its inauguration in 2007. Before we begin, I'd like to first thank the program, Programme des études sur le Québec, the Quebec Studies program here at McGill, for bringing co-sponsored this evening's lecture on multiculturalism. This year we've been exceptionally lucky to have had two Deakin Fellows at McGill, Elspeth Cameron, who was with us in the fall, and organized our Lunch and Learn series on post-war Montreal culture, and James Bigerton, who is here this evening and will be delivering tonight's lecture. And as always, we are so pleased to see so many members of the Deakin family in the audience tonight, including two of the four Deakin children, Gail and Bill. I will be formally introducing Jim in just a moment, but first of all, I'd like to say a few words on behalf of the Dean of Arts, Chris Manfredi, who unfortunately can't be here for the lecture. Dean Manfredi wanted me to share with you how happy he is that the Deakin family has shared of their generosity with McGill Institute for the Study of Canada in the Faculty of Arts. He'd also like to point out that this gift is something that was not only very generous, but also very imaginative. It has allowed McGill Institute for the Study of Canada to welcome one and often two scholars to the MISC, who have been an integral part of the activities of the Institute and who have been able to teach and interact with students in their own disciplines, from history, cultural studies, to political science. And so the gift is something that is not just a piece of equipment or a building or a name or a room, but it's something that's very vibrant and that has affected Faculty of Arts, particularly students, and its teaching profession throughout the years. And we're very happy that the Deakin Fellowship is housed at MISC, continue to bring these kinds of scholars to McGill. I'd like to now introduce Bill Deakin, who will say a few words about William Deakin and whose honor this fellowship was established. Bill Deakin received a Bachelor of Commerce and Diploma in Business Administration from McGill University, and his professional career has been primarily in the marine shipping industry. Since 2007, he's been a chairman of the board of Kenmont Management, Kenmont Terminals, Contour Inc., and FK Warren Limited. He was previously president and CEO of Kenmont Management, Incorporated here in Montreal, and Kenmont Marine in St. Catharines. In addition to many professional activities, he's on the board of directors of a number of foundations in Montreal, including the Montreal Chess Institute Foundation, the Irish Protestant Benevolent Society, and he's the governor of the Montreal General Hospital. I've been wondering if I'd like to say to come to this lecture. This is such an important day. I'm very pleased to welcome Bill Deakin to the podium and to say a few words on behalf of him.
You make me sound much more important.
Well, St. Patrick's Day.
I just come to the St. Patrick's luncheon. Bob Ray, who doesn't have a drop of Irish blood in him, regaled us on Thomas Dorothy McGee's vision of, I guess, old federal. Quite interesting to hear in response. But my father was really very proud of his Irish heritage until I produced a photograph of the old homestead, which by that time had been reduced to a pile of rocks in the middle of a field. And he took a look at it, and he went absolutely silent. Strangely enough, never mentioned it again. Anyway, my father had, I guess, two main interests, well, really three interests, because I assume he had an interest in my mother. I wouldn't be here. But he always maintained throughout his life an interest in Canada. because he graduated from McGill Law. He played quite an essential role and was instrumental in setting up the Frank Scott Chair in Constitutional Studies of Law. So he did that first, and then his second great interest was, of course, McGill. And he sat on interminable committees and the Alumni Association, elected to the board of directors, or governors, I guess you could call it, and became its chairman in the late 70s. So, essentially, that's his story. It seemed like a natural thing to do for a family to set up this fellowship, which combined his love of Canada and his love of McGill. So here we are, and I look forward to Jim's lecture. You enjoy it.
I'm not sure if Jim Bickerton had any Irish in himself. What we do know is that it's been an absolute pleasure to have Jim here in Montreal from Nova Scotia for the past few months. Jim teaches at the Department of Human Science at St. Francis Xavier University, and he's been there since 1984. This is not his first visiting professor stint, however. In 1991-92, he was a visiting scholar at Cornell University in Ithaca, New York, and he's been a visiting professor at Simon Fraser University and the University of Victoria as well. He obtained an honors BA from Acadia University and a master's and PhD degrees from Carleton University in Ottawa. His PhD dissertation, which was supervised by Professor Jane Jensen, who's here this evening as well, had to do with regional development and regionalism, federalism, and regional development policy in Canada. Since then, his research has been in the same areas as well as party and electoral politics. He is a very well-known scholar in Canadian politics, a very respected member of the Academy in our discipline here in Canada, and he is now embarking on new research on Canadian nationalism. He is the author of Nova Scotia, Ottawa, and the Politics of Regional Development, co-author of The All-Mountain of Canadian Politics, of Ties That Bind Parties and Voters in Canada, The Savage Years, and that's another book on politics, by the way, and also Freedom, Equality, and Community. And he's been a co-editor of a very successful textbook that I've been pleased to use in my own classes, Canadian Politics, co-edited with Alain Jacquin. This semester, he's been teaching the politics of regionalism in Canada for the McGill Institute of Study in Canada and the Department of Political Science at McGill. And he's currently working on two projects, New Federalism in Atlantic Canada and New Regional Autonomies in the Canadian He's busy presenting papers on these topics at conferences in Canada and Europe, upcoming trip to Spain, which is very exciting. And we're very pleased that he's been able to take time from his busy research schedule to spend some time with us here at McGill. Students speak very well of Professor Jim Bickerton, and I'm very much looking forward to his talk as you are.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Antonia. First thing I want to do is say a word of thanks myself. And, of course, Antonia and the staff at the McGill Institute for Study of Canada, who have really made me feel very welcome and confirmed my belief that it was the right decision to spend my sabbatical here in Montreal at McGill. Even though some of my colleagues at St. Evex, when they heard I was spending my sabbatical in January coming to Montreal, thought me either admirable as a Canadian for doing that or perhaps a bit crazy. But with the weather we've had, actually, I don't think I'm either admirable or crazy. It's worked out really well, and being here at the Institute has been great. I want to thank, too, Gail Eakin and Des Morton, who hosted me and my wife at their lovely home down in Georgeville, the environs of Georgeville. It's not actually in Georgeville, but we went for a nice ski, and Bill Eakin was part of the group, one of the few skiing days, I think, this year that was available, and that was also a great experience. And as Antonia pointed out,
Jane Jensen is here, which I'm very pleased about. I was not really expecting Jane to be here. She was my PhD thesis supervisor, which makes me feel a bit like a student again. It's hard to believe after all these years you can still feel that way. But she and George Ross, her husband, are here, and thank you very much for coming. So my topic tonight is the New Federalism, made even more difficult by the fact that Bill has now compared it to Darcy McGee's view of federalism, so I have that to live up to. My colleague Alain Gagnon was very dubious about this when I told him I was going to talk about the New Federalism. First thing he said to me, well, what do you mean by that? So I know that there's some uncertainty or doubt or confusion about what the New Federalism is. I'm talking about it actually because I'm giving a paper on it next week down in Halifax, the New Federalism in Atlantic Canada. It's a conference on setting the agenda for Atlantic Canada for the future. They wanted me to talk about the New Federalism. I really didn't know what they meant by that when they asked me to do that. So I have spent some time trying to figure out what's meant by the term the New Federalism. And this is kind of an excerpt from that paper that I have to deliver. Unfortunately, the paper is like 40 pages long, so I'm really going to have to use my synthesizing skills tonight and try to boil it down for you. Right. So the New Federalism. Here are some of the terms that have been applied in the literature over the past 5 or 6 years to our federalism, Canadian federalism. It's been called collaborative, asymmetrical, bilateral, checkbook, checkerboard, open, messy, and networked. And these are all descriptions of Canadian federalism just within the last 5, 6, 7 years. In fact, of course, there's a longer history of new federalisms in Canada. I mean, really, Canadian history is littered with the corpses of new federalisms. They seem to come along, in fact, by my count, at least one every decade. There's a new federalism in Canada. And I think that part of this is because federalism scholars in Canada are a bit obsessed about this. Any sort of shift or change in the relationships between the federal government and the provinces. They want to put a name on it. They want to mark it somehow as a new phase in Canadian federalism. So when you think about new federalism in Canada, it's a bit like Yogi Berra, you know, when he said deja vu all over again, because we've heard this term so many times before in Canadian history, the new federalism. I'm not going to belabor the history of new federalisms in Canada, even though I have it all here in my paper. But, you know, we did in the post-war period have cooperative federalism, which lasted up until around 1970. That was superseded by executive federalism, which was a much more competitive phase, and that was in the 70s and 80s. Trudeau, in 1980, tried to introduce another new federalism. I don't know if you remember that. It was related to his fight with the provinces in those years and his belief that we were getting much too balkanized in Canada, too regionalized, and we needed to reconcentrate power with the federal government. So there was a strategy for a much more nationalist and centralist form of federalism, the National Energy Program, the 1982 Constitution, the Mega Project Industrial Strategy, the Canada Health Act. These were all attempts to bring power back to the center again. As we know, that new federalism actually bit the dust with Trudeau's resignation as Prime Minister, and Brian Mulroney tried to bring in a much more accommodative, province-friendly form of federalism. The Michilake Accord, of course, he got rid of the National Energy Program. He gave Atlantic Canada a new agency, ACOA, that was much more regionalized than the old ones. But Mulroney's accommodative federalism bit the dust too. There was the constitutional accords that failed. There was the recession that was so severe, and so on. So new federalisms have a way of popping up, lasting for a short period of time, and then falling victim to forces that are beyond the ability of political leaders to control. So, by putting the new federalism in context that way, we can understand that what I'm going to say tonight maybe a bit uncertain as to whether or not we actually have a new federalism and what it might be. But there has been quite a bit, actually, of talk about it and writing about it, and that's probably what I will attempt to skip to now. I don't think I have all night here tonight, so I have to try to be a bit briefer. The immediate context for the latest discussion of a new federalism in Canada is the Harper government in Ottawa. And one of the first things that Harper did, even before he became Prime Minister, was during the campaign that led to him becoming Prime Minister, was come to Quebec and to give a speech in which he talked about open federalism. He criticized very heavily the Chrétien-Martin version of federalism. He thought that it was an outrageous use of the federal power and federal spending power that they were engaging in at the time. They were getting involved in cities. They were getting involved in child care. Martin's failed equalization offshore energy accords that ended up being overturned by Harper soon after he became Prime Minister. All of those things were kind of blurring the lines of that distinguished provincial powers from federal powers. A lot of scholars were getting a little bit nervous about this. There were political critics as well, of course. There was a history of the federal government that was not well received by the provinces, and that goes back to the very deep cuts in transfer payments that the Chrétien-Martin team had implemented back in 1995. This was the Canada Health and Social Transfer, the CHST, which is kind of infamous now with the provinces because it's seared into their memory. It was a very deep cut in the money that the federal government provided for social programs. And provinces since then have been very suspicious and lacking in trust of the federal government. They've been asking for more provincial autonomy, less federal interference. They believe that there was a fiscal imbalance created by those cuts that needed to be addressed. And that was the context in which Harper came along and promised his new federalism, which was going to be open federalism. As it happens, federal scholars in Canada had already talked about a new federalism before that, associated with the Chrétien-Martin years. This was collaborative federalism. And this was coming about because the federal government was flush again, had lots of money available because of the budgetary surpluses that were being run up during those years, was engaging in a lot of new spending in the healthcare area, for scholarships, child tax benefits, and many other kinds of new spending. And there was a lot of agreement signed with provinces. So people like David Cameron and Richard Simeon, who published an article in 2002 in Publius, the Journal of Federalism, and they talked about the emergence of collaborative federalism in Canada. And this was going to be the new federalism. And it was going to be governments who were working together collaboratively in an equal partnership on problems that tended to cross jurisdictional lines, you know, part provincial, part federal. And it was a very sort of benign view of what the new federalism was going to be. That all seemed to be placed in doubt by the Harper government coming to power, by the provincial unhappiness with what Martin had been doing with that federal spending power. And open federalism suddenly became potentially Canada's new federalism. And I think that that was what my colleague Alain Gagnon thought I was going to talk about. He thought I was going to talk about open federalism as the new federalism. But not really. I should at least say what open federalism was supposed to be as a replacement for collaborative federalism. There were four principles, really, that Harper laid out for open federalism. One, respect for the Constitution and restoration of what he called a balance between the two levels of government. Now, that refers to the fact that he thought the federal government had been intervening in provincial affairs outside of its constitutional jurisdiction. Secondly, a support for strong provinces and for the Council of the Federation. The Council of the Federation is an organization that the Quebec Premier actually initiated. It is all the provincial premiers together belong to the Council of the Federation, but not the federal government. So it's an interprovincial agency. So open federalism talks about the fact we're going to let the provinces take the lead on things through their own Council of the Federation. Thirdly, limitations on the use of the federal spending power, which is an old complaint, particularly on the part of Quebec. And finally, measures to fix the fiscal imbalance. That is to say, Ottawa had too much money, not enough responsibility. The provinces had too little money and too much responsibility. So Ottawa had to give some of their money to the provinces to try to rebalance that. That was the argument about the fiscal imbalance. Right. So when I looked into the literature on this topic of the new federalism, so you're going to get a little bit of a lit review tonight for me, I actually found that not everyone agreed with the idea that open federalism is new federalism. Some were very skeptical of it, who didn't really see much that was new in it at all. Others thought, well, yes, possibly it will be the new federalism, but they added qualifications to that. Others were very afraid it was going to be the new federalism and argued strongly against it being the new federalism. And finally, there were those who said, no, not this, something completely different. So an alternative model to open federalism was what they thought would happen. So I've kind of grouped all of these together into different schools of thought, different perspectives. I found about 20, actually, different interventions amongst political scientists in Canada on this. Like I said, political scientists in Canada love to talk about new federalisms. So I've managed to kind of group them into 5 different perspectives. These are the status quo skeptics, the Quebec autonomists. Quebec autonomists are always there, of course, on every issue. The progressive pan-Canadians, the collaborative disentanglers, and I'm sorry about that one, but I couldn't find any other way of describing them. And finally, the networked globalists, the future thinkers. I'll say a bit about each. The status quo skeptics, those are the political scientists who said this open federalism really doesn't amount to much at all. They tended to emphasize path dependency, that is to say that change comes very incrementally in Canadian federalism. You don't usually get dramatic changes of direction. Also, they tended to emphasize that this was mainly a short-term partisan strategy on the part of Harper and the Conservatives aimed squarely at Quebec. In other words, they came up with it to win votes in Quebec. But there wasn't enough there to actually say that they were going to do something completely different in power. So a lot of political symbolism, electoral strategizing, not much in the way of content. So we have people like Roger Gibbons, Keith Banting, Graham Fox, Harvey Lazar, all well-known political scientists in Canada, who are making this argument in one form or another, basically saying that federal governments seldom get the federalism they want. So even if he wanted to change federalism dramatically, it would be unlikely that he would succeed in doing that. And, of course, they pointed to all the things that didn't change with the present Harper government. I mean, mostly we've continued on the same path we were on before. All of the major federal-provincial transfer agreements have been renewed to 2013-14. Equalization has actually been restored more to the way it used to be before Martin came along. So he's even, you know, reinforcing the federalism that existed previously, not striking out in a new direction. There were a couple of changes that he made. He canceled the Liberal Child Care Initiative and instead is sending out monthly checks to families of young children. So that's a little different. And, of course, he canceled the Aboriginal Kelowna Accord. But in both cases, made promises that they would be coming forward with their own new initiatives in these areas. They weren't abandoning them, and so on. So that was the status quo skeptics. The Quebec autonomists, and basically I found several versions of Quebec autonomists talking about open federalism as the new federalism. And they kind of range from one end of the spectrum. I took Caron and Laforêt and their article on this topic. And basically they argue that Harper federalism is no different than Trudeau federalism. And I'm talking about the centralist, interventionist, nationalist Trudeau federalism that I said had failed. In fact, Caron and Laforêt say that that has continued. They call it a monist model of federalism, which can never address what Quebec needs, which is differential and asymmetrical treatment within Canada. It's a very familiar argument to us all. Alain Noël is another Quebec autonomist who was a little bit less negative, and he emphasized again what was needed to really accommodate Quebec within Canada. And Alain Noël talks about double-packed federation. He says Quebec is both an autonomous province and it is a nation. And as a result, it needs the capacity both to act as an autonomous province in league with other provinces and also as a national state, which needs to be recognized as such by its partners within the federation. He says that open federalism falls short on both of those counts. So we did have, you know, we did have a few initiatives from the Harper government, not insignificant in at least in English-speaking Canada. We had the UNESCO initiative, which gave Quebec a seat on the United Nations Education and Social Council. We had the Quebecois Nation Resolution in Parliament, recognizing Quebec as a nation, parliamentary resolution as such. And we did have, of course, the major attempt to fix the fiscal imbalance, and that was by increasing equalization, which particularly benefited Quebec. Quebec was the main beneficiary of the changes in the equalization formula. But even with this, Noël says, you know, this really doesn't go far enough. It's not substantive enough. The third Quebec autonomist I chose was Éric Monpetit because he's a little bit more optimistic about new federalism meeting Quebec's needs. He basically says that if this continues, what he means by this is small, successive, fragmented policy changes at the margins of the status quo, what he calls disjointed incrementalism as an approach. He said if that continues, you could end up with a more radically asymmetrical Canada. In other words, Quebec really treated quite differently than everybody else. Without risking again another Meech Lake or Charlottetown clash of visions, which risked an explosion of Canada. So he said, okay, you know, small, tiny steps, baby steps will get us there. People have to be patient if the Harper government is serious about continuing in that vein. So that's the kind of the spectrum of the Quebec autonomous point of view. The progressive pan-Canadians, that's the third group that I mentioned. And essentially, these are coming at the question of the new federalism from a social democratic, left-of-center point of view, Canadian nationalists all. They see the new federalism in very nefarious terms, that this is really a very right-wing, neoliberal attempt to kneecap the federal government so that it won't be capable, really, of acting in the interests of all Canadians, in the national interest. They think that what it's motivated by is a theory of federalism, which is referred to as classical federalism sometimes. The provinces are given sort of maximum leeway to regulate their societies. All the federal government should do is to protect the common market, take care of national defense, protect property rights, and then leave everything else to the provinces. And why right-wingers like that is because they think it will result in a very competitive federalism, where provinces will compete with one another for investment. It will tend to drive down social regulation within society, you'll get a more open market and a better situation for free market capitalism. And this is what the progressive pan-Canadians are very afraid of, actually. So Harms and White and Tom Kent, who's a familiar Canadian nationalist, they're all writing from this perspective. Of the three of them, it's Kent that stands out a bit because he actually agrees that shared cost federalism, the provinces and the federal government working together, he actually agrees that that model is broken. And he says it's broken irreparably. And he does lay the blame for that at the door of the federal government. He says their past behavior, especially the CHST and other unilateral measures like that, really spoiled the chance for any sort of federal-provincial cooperation in the future, such as they had in the 1960s when they set up these shared cost programs like health care and other national social programs like that. But Kent believes that the federal government still has an obligation and should still pursue a progressive agenda. But he says the way they have to do that now is through direct spending. In other words, spend directly on individuals, spend directly on organizations. Don't go through the provinces at all. And he says the federal government can do this. It's recognized they have the power to do this in the Social Union Framework Agreement. And he thinks they should immediately begin to spend more on income security, skills upgrading, post-secondary education, childcare, and so forth. So he's still on the left. He's still a progressive pan-Canadian. He just thinks that the federal government has to go it alone now and more or less ignore the provinces. Much more Trudeauist, right, in his approach than the others. The fourth group is that ugly name, the collaborative disentanglers. You might not be surprised that this is actually the largest group of Canadian federal scholars. They fall into this category, and the reason is because it's the most nuanced and conflicted category, a little of this, a little of that kind of attitude, not really as clear as the other categories. And academics generally tend to gravitate towards that sort of attitude towards things. Their view is that open federalism does have potential because it is congruent with trends within the Federation. In other words, they see, okay, the Federation seems to be going in this direction anyway. Open federalism just continues along that direction, which is sort of the federal government kind of pulling back a bit, the provinces taking more autonomy over social affairs. They think that that will continue. Secondly, they think that functionally this is what we need. So collaborative disentanglers tend to be kind of legalistic, constitutionalistic, let me say. Their mindset is we have to try to recognize that the Constitution means something, that the division of powers means something, and therefore that the federal government should really be giving the provinces greater freedom in their areas of jurisdiction. So those are the things that set them apart. Funny, Gibbons ends up in this category too. He was in one other category. But the thing about Roger Gibbons is he was a longtime political scientist, academic at the University of Calgary. Then he became the president of the Canada West Foundation, which is kind of a private sector think tank in Western Canada. So he talks one way when he's speaking as an academic. Then he puts on his Canada West Foundation hat and he talks in a different way. So that's why he ends up in two categories here. Gibbons is at one end of the spectrum. He's more disentangler than collaborationist. And he really thinks that all provinces are distinct societies in Canada. And all provinces need to be given the freedom to intervene and structure their societies in the way that they see fit. Well, he's an Albertan, remember that, okay? So there's a meeting of minds with Quebec, clearly, on this. But he sees the need, unlike the Quebec autonomous, he sees the need for the federal government to balance this out. Okay, if we're going to let the provinces do what they want in social affairs, then the federal government has to have much more authority over the economic union. So he wants them to step in, guarantee the common market, wipe out all the barriers to trade between provinces. A national securities regulator is clearly one of the things that he thinks should happen. In addition to that, he does make one exception for the federal government intervening in social affairs, and that's in universities and post-secondary education. And he thinks, you know what, the federal government, this is too important now to our national competitiveness, so Soy provinces, the federal government's going to have to step in and play a much bigger role there too in post-secondary education. So, but other than that, he said, disentangle, right? Richard Simeon sort of makes the same argument. He's saying, federal government, stick to your knitting, exactly the phrase that he uses. In other words, that they should stick to the things they do best. There should be a clear division of responsibility in Canada, so they need to withdraw from social affairs. Robert Young argues the same thing, especially with regard to municipalities, which, of course, the Martin Liberals had intervened with their city's agenda and municipalities. All of them, however, sort of recognize that, you know what, we're not ever going to get back to good old classical federalism, where there's a complete separation of the two governments. So there is still going to need to be collaboration going on. But the provinces will be primary in social affairs. They should be given the lead in these things. The federal government will be standing by to help out if the provinces ask them to. That sort of is their attitude. They also recognize that Quebec is a distinct society within Canada. We need to take kind of a du-nation approach. So the federal government has to be sensitive to the fact that we have to find a way to accommodate Quebec's difference. And so all of them say that Quebec should be able to gain more autonomy because of its distinct status. But they're reluctant to deny that to other provinces too. So it's back to that old Canadian conundrum. So the argument there is we should have a generalized asymmetry. Every province should be able to do what it wants and be given the freedom to do so. So again, it seems to be provincial equality with Quebec's special distinctness. That sounds familiar? It's because it goes back to the Meech Lake Accord, to the Calgary Declaration, and everything we've been talking about up to now. So it's still there. The last category is the networked globalists. Their frame of reference is completely different. They don't look to the Constitution. They don't look to Canadian history as a guide. What they look to is the present and future social and economic reality. And they argue that this is the new frame of reference, and this is what's going to determine what government does in the future. So there's a bit of a functionalist argument here. They're basically of the opinion that because this is what needs to happen in order to compete in the global economy, this will happen. So you have to beware a little bit about that kind of functionalist cast to their arguments. But they do predict that, in fact, we will not have disengagement in the future. Quite the contrary. They argue that what we're going to have in the future is more engagement, that the federal and provincial governments are going to become even more intertwined and intermingled with one another, that the problems that they will face will require a multi-level approach, that what's important in the future is not sort of independent silos and authoritative allocation by one government or another. What's important in the future instead is policy networks. And more than that, they have to be sticky networks. So this is the group that talks about messy federalism, sticky networks, terms that are new to the discourse on Canadian federalism. But essentially, you know, what they're arguing is, especially in the big cities, trying to disentangle the two governments in the future is a hopeless prospect. That the problems that they will face will require the governments to work together. So it really is a sort of a functional need argument. They're going to have to work together. They're not going to be able to avoid it. The problems that they will face, the challenges they face are so great and complex that they're going to have to sort it out and work together. More than that, they're going to have to bring in other people into solving policy problems. Governments alone can't do it anymore. They have to bring in civil society actors too, policy expertise wherever they can find it. They're going to have to be much more open They're going to have to be much more collaborative, to use that term again. And they're going to have to lighten up on the whole power discourse about who has the power and who doesn't have the power. In the future, instead, what's going to be important is that they work together. And that's why they call it sticky networks. The social glue for the for this networking that's going to happen, it's essentially a consensus on norms. It's essentially trust ties between actors. The kind of thing that we've lost, actually, in Canadian federalism over the past couple of decades, at least, but which the network globalists think we have to have again. A change in elite culture is called for here. And by elite culture, they're talking about governing elites, political and bureaucratic. The network globalists see them as a stumbling block here, that they have to get with the program. They have to learn how to adapt to the new situation. But at the same time, the network globalists think this will happen because governments will be forced to work together. And simply the act of repeated rounds of problem solving, iterated rounds of problem solving is the term they use, that institutions will adapt to this. So individuals within those institutions will adapt to it. So in other words, we will have the growth of these sticky networks through the doing that will create, in fact, what we need to have it. So those are the... I never mentioned who the network globalists were. The two that I took are Janice Grosstein and Thomas Corshane, who are two very eminent academics in Canada, political scientists and economists, who have written a lot on these topics and who come at it from different ends of the ideological spectrum, actually. Corshane tends to be on the right, Stein on the left, and yet they certainly do have points of agreement when it comes to what the future holds for Canadian federalism, and it's a very different direction than the disentanglement or the even the status quo skeptics. Okay, I'm going to try to take about another 5 minutes and finish up my talk here. From my point of view, I'm quite convinced by the argument of the network globalists. And I'm not sure if this is because they tend to say things very authoritatively. This will happen. The global economy requires this to happen. And it does kind of win you over, you know, as you're reading this stuff. And say, yeah, that's right. That's got to happen that way. So although I'm leaning in that direction, I'm also a political scientist who studies federalism in Canada. So I know that we have this history of a certain institutional geography. We have this issue of, you know, dual nations and so on. So it's clearly not going to be an easy transition to the kind of federalism that they envisage, this kind of network that they envisage. So I think that in the Canadian case, we'll have our own particular Canadian path and our own particular Canadian adaptation in that direction, but I do think I am in agreement with the idea that the problems that governments face now are very complex problems, and they've been building momentum over the last decade in particular, and that those problems are probably going to force the federal government to step up to the plate. In other words, even a reluctant federal government, the Harper government maybe, is going to be forced to take a leadership role here. The kind of problems I'm talking about, one, an unsustainable rate of increase in healthcare costs. That's an old one, but it's not going away. If anything, it's getting worse. The nexus of energy and environmental policies, which, as you know, is becoming more and more a major policy on the agenda of governments, clean energy, climate change. The demographic challenge of an aging population and a shrinking workforce, this is going to become a huge problem, which governments really don't know what to do about. Quebec, of course, has family policies to try to increase the birth rate in Quebec. We haven't seen that replicated elsewhere in Canada. It's even doubtful whether, in fact, that alone will be able to meet this challenge. We may just need to keep people working longer as a solution, but nonetheless, it will be a big challenge in years to come. The needs of large urban agglomerations, good economics term, city regions, they're really the magnets for immigration and the engines of growth now in all developed societies. And it's clear that Canadian federalism isn't well constructed to address their problems and their needs. And, of course, the problem of productivity and economic competitiveness, that's always seems to be there in the background. And there's a lot of complaints about poor productivity in Canada. What can we do about it? Article after article about this that I read. You know, we still have the older problems, too. Dare I say regional inequality? I mean, I am coming to you from Nova Scotia, from St. Francis Xavier University, so that's not going away. The decline of rural areas, everywhere rural areas are in decline. And Quebec's demand for national recognition and extension of its autonomy. That's also an old problem that will continue. But I also have noted from just from reading Canadian history that the more pressing and widely shared the problem, generally the more demand for a federal leadership role there is from Canadians. And, you know, you look at the public opinion polls, you look at the surveys, Canadian nationalism and national sentiment and national identity, everywhere outside Quebec at least, has been growing stronger, not getting weaker. And over the last couple of decades, that's clearly been the case. From the surveys are identifying that. People essentially, I think, and this is probably what convinces me the most that the federal government's not going to be able to back away from things, people will not allow the federal government to back away from things. If problems really are that great and that complex and begin to bite, they're going to demand that their federal government step in, work with other governments, coordinate some kind of response to these problems. They're not going to be able to back away from them. So I guess just in closing, I would say that even with the so-called looming problem of government finances, we have a big deficit now, as you know. And in the recent past, this was a no-go area for politicians. They have been very reluctant to do anything to incur a deficit, and if they have one, they immediately have to put that ahead of everything else. So there's been a lot of talk in the media about the fact, all the media commentators, who suggest that, you know what, this is going to become the number one priority. Everything else will take second, play second fiddle to this. I'm even a little dubious about that now, actually. You know, now that we've crossed that Rubicon with this big deficit that the current government has, perhaps it won't recover its mesmerizing power that it's had, you know, for the last 20 years, the deficit, that is. In other words, every other issue has to play take second place to the deficit. I'm not sure that that will be the case in the future. I think the large problems that governments are going to face in Canada, the relatively small and mild deficit that we have compared to everybody else in amongst the developed countries, I think it's going to be harder to make that argument in the future that the deficit has to be given priority and everything else has to play second fiddle. So, in closing, you'll be happy to hear that. You might be feeling a bit aggrieved at this point. If you came tonight expecting me to tell you what the new federalism was going to be, and you know what, you'd be right. And all I can do is apologize for that. And the title of the lecture, it's a little bit of the old academic bait and switch, you know. You try to give people something they think they're going to, you know, going to get and give them something else instead. But we do that all the time, right, because we're desperate to get an audience, any kind of an audience. So you have to try to do that. You might also feel that, you know, tonight's speaker is still a little uncertain about this whole thing, and you'd be right about that too. In my defense, indeterminacy, that's another great social science term, is really the norm in what we do. even though some economists are loath to admit that, right? And given the range of opinion I came across amongst experts in Canadian federalism, all have devoted lots of energy to this topic, I'm clearly not alone, right, in my uncertainty. So misery loves company. And perhaps, after all, the most important thing is just to recognize the influences and factors that will have a bearing on Canada's new federalism, whatever ultimately that may be. Thank you very much. Good. My students, I see some here tonight.
So my question is, as a political science, I'm trying to figure out which of the five categories I'm in. This topic related, what was the first one? That's probably the one that's
collaborative disentanglers?
Yeah,
I would have guessed you for one of those.
But, so that's the experts.
Right.
Where do you think most Canadians see new federalism?
Right. To be honest, I think that there's a great resonance in English-speaking Canada for kind of like the progressive pan-Canadian point of view. You know, that the national government has to play an important role sort of in those interests that we share as a nation, as a community. So I think that there is a certain resonance there with that that can be tapped. I know that the current government, which did win the last couple of elections, doesn't closely reflect that. But who knows, with the Olympics and everything, that just, you know, people are feeling very nationalistic these days. So I think there's a lot of subterranean feeling in English-speaking Canada of that sort. Of course, in Quebec, it's different. And you have, you know, Francophone Quebecers obviously are very wedded to Quebec autonomy point of view. So I think that will always probably take preeminence in Quebec. So I think that there absolutely is a sense of being two nations in Canada, that governments have to be able to appeal to both of them simultaneously, somehow.
Right.
Yes.
So I'd like to ask then questions in
come on, I paid you well enough.
All right. Well, in the absence of a student, I'm going to ask for Professor Jane Jensen.
Oh, God, no. It's like my oral all over again. I didn't include you, though, Jane. Right?
Love,
sweet love.
And this kind of relationship, and that's why you see the day-to-day functions. Where the other set of people are your traditional federalist scholars who say the problem is that I want to work on is federalism, and therefore I'm going to focus on whether it should be this kind of federalism or that kind of federalism.
Yeah.
So if that's the distinction, then this is my question.
Yes.
Do those four groups of people have anything to say with anymore? Or is the study of federalism in date. The real action is on what particular government should be doing to solve real, all the problems that exist in Afghanistan.
That really is a thesis examination question, you know. You fell back into that so easily. I couldn't knock you off the path. I knew. Yeah. The best before date. Well, you know, political scientists in Canada would not like that. They see themselves as the experts on federalism, and the idea that they may be passé is something that they would certainly chafe at that idea. They'll recover their position, though. I did kind of say that I thought that I'm not comfortable with kind of the functionalist cast of the network globalist kind of argument. You know, this will happen because it needs to happen, which you come across over and over. So my training tells me don't go there. Don't fall for that one. And I think political scientists would probably respond the same way. They say that there is a compelling attraction of that kind of an argument, and certainly they bring to the table a whole reality that's unfolding, and that it is going to have an impact. There's no question about that. But it will happen, you know, within the context of how federal-provincial relations are structured in Canada, what the established institutions are that are laid out. That there's going to have to be adaptation, you know, melding somewhere in the middle. But, it certainly doesn't look good for that group who were strongly on the disengage side of things, who basically are saying, no, what we got to do is just separate the fighters, put them in their own corner, and keep them separated in their own corner, which is attractive from a constitutionalist point of view for sure. Because it's a way of getting, you know, toning down the conflict. And but honestly, I just don't think that's sustainable. And I do agree to a certain extent with Stein and Corshane, who say, you know what, it's just an avoidance strategy and it won't work. So I find myself, you know, with a foot in each camp. Do I pass?
At the risk of oversimplification, surely the genius of Canadian federalism is precisely its amorphous nature, because rather than being indeterminate, it allowed each group and its experts to believe that they have the correct version. And to quote a famous opening of a Leacock story of the rider who jumps on a horse and gallops madly in all directions.
Yes.
Now, given this sort of conglomeration of interests, balance or otherwise, what makes you think that even necessity is going to change this and bring clarity and some common purpose for the future? Now, I know you can't predict the future,
right,
but you seem to believe that a kind of consolidation is likely to happen, even though you may not know the exact form. I'm questioning that belief.
Right.
For the sake of discussion,
I probably didn't make clear enough that I'm actually leaning in the direction of messiness in the future, not clarity. So I'm not of the opinion that we'll have more clarity of roles in the future. I'm of the opinion that, in fact, we're going to have more messiness in the future. So the premise of your question, in terms of placing me, I think, is incorrect.
Well,
I don't know how to answer in that sense, right? Because I'm a woman, and all that, I don't agree with that. So I'm with you. I think we're of the same mind, actually.
Yeah, but you seem to suggest that there's a growing consensus that there has to be a stronger role for the federal government in terms of economic and social factors,
right,
which obviously, and you also seem to suggest that there was a growing pan-nationalism, so all of those coalescing would somehow suggest a somehow clearer picture of new federalism.
You'd think so, but actually it just makes it messier. Because the provinces are so well entrenched in their jurisdictions, and they have such a prominent role in social policies in particular, that the federal government coming in creates the messiness. It's not like the provinces are going to retreat as the federal government comes in. It's that you're going to get those actors ever more intermingled and intertwined, right? So creative ambiguity, is that the term you used? It's very true that Canada and Canadian federalism has relied a lot in the past on creative ambiguity so that everybody can go home thinking that they got something of what they wanted out of it, and I think that will continue.
Mm-hmm. Because when we try to spell it out, that's when problems happen. So it's funny that Bob Ray's name was mentioned today.
Yes.
Mentioned with Darcy D, but I mean, the other reason we could mention his name is because of the Shelton Report, where we actually had it black and white on paper about whether or not we agreed and the ambiguity went out.
Yeah, right.
George.
This is a little bit of an outsider point of view of the United States economy. But it's easy to categorize political science, but it's not so easy to talk about political strategies. When you talk about federalism, you're also talking about the strategies of actors to maximize their influence, right?
Right.
I heard two strategies that made some sense to me from my American point of view.
Okay.
One is the one that we seem to be adopting, but very, very softly.
Yes.
And the other is the one that I think that Harper is probably really committed to.
Yeah.
That the promise is there.
Yeah.
Which makes a lot of sense electorally, it seems to me.
Yeah.
And yours doesn't make a hell of a lot of sense electorally.
Yeah.
I mean, why is the American example important? We have a range in the United States, anti-elitism, anti-networks, all that stuff, and it's raising hell, and the kind of compromise strategy seems to be
right.
On fire.
There are different countries, though. and I do think they have different political cultures, too. And different histories, and so I'm not sure that the comparison is all that useful in terms of trying to figure out what's going to happen in Canada by looking at the U.S. Not that it's irrelevant, of course it's not irrelevant, but political strategies, the big part that I cut out tonight was looking at the corpses of dead federalisms from the past, and oftentimes it was related to a failed political strategy, and that there was always an automatic reset for governments afterwards. And this was true even with the 82 Constitution, Trudeau's 82 Constitution, which kind of put a poison pill into Quebec-Canada relations, and the CHST, which was successful, eliminated the deficit. But you know what? Each time, the federal government had to come back and find a way to reach a consensual partnership with the provinces. You know, each time the clear federal strategy that they had in mind fell flat, and then it reset to what is the normal state of affairs in Canada, it seems to me, which is some kind of consensual partnership between the two levels of government. So I'm of an inclination to think that likely will be what will happen, even if Harper gets his majority. If he really does have a chance to put into place that strategy and really tries to take us in that direction, I think it'll fall flat eventually and we'll reset. That's what I think.
The other day I saw on the news that the demography of Canada is going to
dramatically. Yeah, that's a good question. I really haven't given a whole lot of thought to what impact the new demography, as you call it, will have on Canadian federalism, but it's a very good question. I know it's something that others are giving a lot of thought to. I mean, there's a huge research project, the Metropolis Project in Canada, which is looking a lot at that very issue. unfortunately, it's kind of outside my area of expertise, but it, when you brought up the poll, and it was CBC News, is that what you're talking about? I often wonder who responds to that poll, because like all the responses were, Canada is love, Canada is tolerance, Canada is bringing everyone together. I mean, every one of the responses was, we are the greatest thing since sliced bread, right? So you kind of, it does kind of bring out that view. People don't want to think badly of themselves or their country, and so it kind of brings out that.
I think it's the airport. It's because the nasty people are making dinner at 5 and
they're hanging. Oh, maybe that's it, yeah.
I am an optimist. I'm reminded of Jeffrey's quip that Canada is a country that works in practice, but not in theory. So here we have all these theories of how it should work, and I think the answer will be a mix of all of them in terms of sectorial. You listen toward the end of your speech, different areas like health or environment and so forth and so forth. I think what will happen in the mix is that in some areas there will be more strong federal input, in other areas less so. Mm. And it will be a mishmash, and academics won't like it because it's not all neat and all the same theory. Mm-hmm. But somehow or other, we bubbled through.
Right. See, I bet you answered that poll, didn't you? CBC poll.
Okay, we're going to take the 3 questions one after another.
Who's up?
Somebody else? I wanted to say something about Harper. I mean, Harper actually got involved in politics when Trudeau nationalized the Canada.
Yeah.
And one of his actually goals when he went into politics is to basically privatize the Canada and keep all the natural resources, like the energy resources of Alberta, to Alberta.
Yeah.
Which is, I'm sure it's the question about what interests do these particular groups represent. For example, Pan-Canadian is the West Pan-Canadianism is mostly attracted to area, so you have much more control of Canada or what we have as well and all that. Quebec has more of the autonomy issue because of which nationalism, separatism, and more of the economic powers, tax powers especially. So it also raises the issue like it's almost like in the European Union, whereby you have the German French cooperative group which wants a stronger European federalism in Europe. You have the United Kingdom which wants a more neoliberal, more national, it's more international, not national, but each national government has more power so that they can have more power in that group. So in that sense, we have the same situation.
So first we had the American, now we have the European examples.
You're not going to be let off the hook.
Yeah. Not sure of the question, though.
Well, the question is, the idea that you raised, isn't it our birth under Harper trying to make way down the centralized government? If they could.
I see.
Simply on the basis that their protectivist interest in Alberta.
The firewall strategy kind of thing. Yeah. Well, you know.
They don't care about if Quebec wants to separate, have them separate,
yeah. Now, this may be because it's a minority situation. But in 4 years, federal spending has gone up dramatically under a Harper government. So it's really hard to discern the evidence of any kind of radical ideological agenda so far. Now people will say, oh yeah, but wait till he gets his majority. Then you'll see it, right? That's what you're thinking, right? And you may be right, too. Yeah, you may be right. It depends on, you know, how much we have Harper the ideologue versus Harper the electoral, you know, maximizer animal, yeah. Yeah. I agree with you. I have no doubt that his base ideology is that kind of provincial, autonomous, neoliberal. Well, yeah, it's a popular point of view. But even in Alberta, and you were talking about, you know, is Canada really a regionalized country? But, you know, we're not nearly as regionalized as we think we are. Even Alberta, I mean, we tend to think of Albertans as a very homogeneous right-wing, redneck bunch out there. Yes. But it certainly doesn't show up that way in survey data. Right? So we're kind of lured into thinking that way, you know, because of our electoral system. It produces landslides for one party in one province, and it makes us think about them in a particular way. But there's much more commonality shared in terms of values, right, across Canada than is apparent from, you know, which political party succeeds in which region. There really is quite a, you know, quite a bedrock of shared values that Canadians have, if you believe survey data. Right? Well, I don't know if elites in Canada really are, you know, we can get an argument, well, no point in getting in an argument about that. Immigrants. Yeah.
And it seems that when you think about those problems, the problems, in light of the division of power as it was thought of 100 years or so years ago, perhaps it just doesn't work anymore. And that we will have to go toward this idea of the global network globalism.
Yes.
I'm a legal scholar, so I look at things from this point of view, and when I look at what has been done or what is being done right now in the protection of in the field of protecting privacy rights or recognizing foreign credentials, for example, you can see that there's a network there already in place, and that is working quite well, too.
Okay.
So I'm wondering if the question would be more a good way of thinking about the information, or whether we'll have to think otherwise. For example, when we think about foreign credentials or getting privacy rights, very often the issues are framed in terms of protecting freedoms of rights affected by the Charter, or they will think in terms of general commerce, so the general power over commerce.
Yeah. Yeah.
So they are thought of in light of these two extremes.
Right. I'd say next to constitutional lawyers, political scientists, and when anybody think about these things, which is what makes us as a group really odd, you know, compared to the rest of Canada, because most Canadians don't tend to think that way about who has the power of this, who has the power of that. What voters generally want is they want action, they want governments to act, they want, you know, problems to be solved. They're not particularly concerned, and again, I guess I have to put, you know, Quebec nationalists over here as an exception to that, maybe, not particularly concerned about which government does it. So that's why I think there's a popular kind of pressure that counteracts the tendency to fall back into neat constitutional categories to solve problems. So yeah, we think about it a lot. Is that the question? Do we think about it a lot? I mean, that would be my response. And but I think that your comments sort of have, you're clearly a network globalist in your thinking, and I think that, yes, yeah.
Yeah. Thank you very much. Thanks for those questions. Thank you very much. I have to say again how grateful we are to have you here this year with us at McGill. Are really happy in your classes, and we'd love to have you here as a colleague. And I'd like to thank you all for being here, and again, thanks to the Eakin family. We're gathered here in the Heritage Room at the Faculty Club, and the Eakin gift has now become part of not only McGill Institute of Study Canada, but the Faculty of Art and McGill University Heritage. So thank you very much again. Melanie Thomas is a PhD student in Canadian political science.
Oh.
Thank you very much for your presentation. I found it very intellectually stimulating and also somewhat disconcerting, being unable to place myself completely.
Oh, that's all right.
So, on behalf of the McGill Institute for the Study of Canada, I'd like to present you with this talk.
Oh, thank you very much. Thank you very much, Melanie.
No green beer.
also have to ask, when Dr. Gibbons was wearing his hat,